And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Brendan Watkins, who is the author of a new memoir called Tell No One. Tell No One is the memoir of a 50-year quest by Brendan to uncover the truth when confronted by the big institutions, the Catholic Church, and in some cases the government. Over the past 4 years, Brendan has engaged with sons and daughters of priests, mothers of the children of priests, nuns, failed priests, and as well as that, lawyers, psychologists, doctors, and sex abuse counsellors. This is Brendan's story. It is who he is. Brendan, good afternoon and welcome to Dads on the Air.
G'day, Bill. Thanks for the invitation.
So, Brendan, some people might be shocked about the subject matter of Tell No One. Were you shocked yourself?
Yeah, look, initially I was. Initially I was flabbergasted. But the more searching I did and the more research I did, the more I realised it wasn't such a weird thing after all. It certainly not something that's spoken about in the public domain, but, yeah, look, the fact is nuns have children, but more so priests have children, and very often when priests have children, they abandon them.
I guess the particularly unusual part of your story, though, was that it was a priest and a nun involved, not perhaps a nun at the time you were conceived, but before and after, which is quite unusual.
Yeah, my mother had been in the convent for 18 months, 2 years, and had resigned, had left, and I was conceived, and then a couple of years later she joined another convent, so technically she wasn't, but in many ways, in her words, she rejoined a convent, a fairly stern, strict order, and stayed there for 25 years, basically paying for her sin, you know, probably unfortunately for her. When she came out, or very shortly after she came out, I got a hold of my original birth certificate and made contact with her. So I suppose she thought she'd paid for her sins, and then she had to deal with my questions.
You were 29 when you decided to find out the real story of your birth parents, and you're now 62. Why are you telling this very personal story now?
In a lot of ways, I'm sort of an accidental author or an unintentional author. I didn't sort of set out to write a book that I necessarily wanted to have published, but you know, it's a story that went over 30 years, really. You know, I found out my mother had been a nun 30 years ago, and I found out 4 years, 5 years ago that my father was a priest. And what I was really trying to do was just map out the complexities of my story. You know, I've always journaled throughout my life and written, you know, tens of thousands of words every year. And I really wanted to take a year off just to sit down and record what had happened. And once I'd recorded the complexities of what had happened, to work out how I felt about it. And, you know, the more I researched and dug, and the more I looked into what the church was doing to silence the children of priests, and the pain and the outrage of many people that I met that were children of priests, or the mothers of, that I sort of felt I had an obligation to make it public, because there were, you know, so many people that were very damaged by the church and had been silenced. And I just thought, no one's talking about this. People need to know that this is going on. And hence I, you know, probably 2-3 years ago, started feeling really strongly that this needed to be a book that was published and people need to learn about it.
You've shown incredible persistence, I think, in coming up against all these brick walls. I mean, the institutions don't get much bigger and more secretive than the Catholic Church and the government, but you seem to have been able to. I think at one stage you say you rattled the cages of some government department. I'm amazed that one little person can, you know, can have such an effect and dig up all these stories.
Yeah, well, I'm persistent. I don't give up, and probably my professional life allowed me to gather some skills that were really helpful in doing what I was doing. Persistence will get you a hell of a long way, but I kind of knew how to deal with organisations and how to extract information and how to, you know, find the back door if the front door's locked. And so I was fortunate. You know, ironically, I think there's a lot of good people in these institutions that aren't necessarily helpful. I was helped by a lot of people within the church and helped by a lot of people within, you know, they normally get a bad rap, but I think there's a lot of good people in those institutions that want people to have good outcomes. So, yeah, I had the time. Well, I sort of made the time, I suppose. I quit my job to research for a year, and it ended up being 5 years. But, I'm very glad it's done, and I feel really freed by the fact that I've finally researched and found out what happened with my ancestry and who my parents were, and now that it's out of my system and it's a book and it's in the world.
Yeah, you were helped in the later stages with the advent of DNA and also, say, the Trove service that makes it available for people to check stories from going past. I think you used Ancestry, and Society of Australian Genealogists, I know, offers courses in DNA. Did you undertake any special instruction to find out to use those resources?
I didn't, no. I'd hoped, as many people do, you know, you do your DNA through Ancestry, who are the largest DNA organisation on the planet. But, you know, a lot of people just send the DNA in and they get the answers they're looking for. Mine was particularly complicated, and, you know, I've got to fess up, it wasn't entirely my endeavour that brought my father about. It did take, well, we found him in August 19, and I gave my DNA in 2015, and I had a huge number of distant relatives, you know, third and fourth and fifth cousins, but no one terribly close. And it was my partner, Kate, that did all the slog work to actually find him, and she was, you know, she's as dogged as I am about these things, and spent, you know, hundreds of hours on not only Trove, but, you know, electoral rolls and phone books and, you know, databases on priests and nuns, and did an enormous amount of legwork to put the pieces together. I mean, an enormous undertaking that, you know, I was like chat busy, but look, I just didn't have the patience or the sort of skill sets that she had to be able to get to the end to identify my father.
And that was another, very important part of the puzzle, that you had that very supportive base with your partner, Kate, your kids, and even going back to those loving adoptive parents that gave you that solid foundation, I guess. But do you think they would have encouraged you to go looking for the truth in this way?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. Possibly not. You know, I know when I first found out my mother 30 years ago was a nun, you know, I deliberately didn't dig as hard as I could have when they were alive. I found out she was a nun after they both passed away. They were quite devout Catholics, and they would have been, well, more flabbergasted than I was. You know, I wasn't particularly religious. You know, I knew nuns were supposed to be virgins, and obviously mine wasn't. But I think at the end of the day, they would have wanted whatever I wanted. That they wouldn't have stopped me trying to sort of go against the church and keep asking questions. All my parents wanted was for my brother Damien and I to be happy and feel supported and loved, and we did. But yeah, look, the initial news, they would have been absolutely knocked out. And then to have found my father was a priest, yeah, it's staggering for people to believe. And I guess in a lot of ways I was kind of helped that I had stopped going to church 40 years ago and consider myself to be an atheist. So the news that it was a priest and a nun wasn't shocking, and it didn't disturb me in any way either. The whole celibacy palaver that the church peddles, I think everybody knows it's not the real thing. The Royal Commission, the recent Royal Commission, holds a magnifier over that. So I wasn't shocked, but yeah, my parents, it really would have set them back. And they were even, you know, reasonably close. And my father thought a lot of George Pell. Given what happened with George after my father's death, it would have also shaken his foundations.
But I also think your birth mother was put in that terrible position for any parent where, you know, she wants the best for her child. And even, say, 60 years ago, you could well have been victimised through no fault of your own, but for your past if it came out, I guess.
Yeah, look, I was very grumpy with my mother for a long time. She didn't want contact, and she told me a lot of stories that weren't true about my father. You know, I could sort of understand, I suppose, in one way that she didn't want anything to do with me. But, I thought I had a birthright to the details about my father, and she denied me that. And it's only now in, the last few years that I've realised how difficult her situation was and how her situation really is the facsimile of so many other women that have had children to priests. You know, she's pretty much a stereotype. She was much younger than my father. She didn't have an education. She didn't have money. She didn't have family to fall back on. She was very vulnerable. My father was 30 years older. You know, I didn't know any of that at the time, obviously. Over this last 30 years, it's only recently that I've found out, and it's only recently that I've spoken to other women in the position she's been in. And then I found out many of them had been gagged with NDAs and confidentiality agreements that the church has imposed on the mothers and some of the children. And so, you know, I'm really glad I've done the research to find these things out, to find out this is the situation these women are in. And, yeah, I've done a total 180 degrees. I feel nothing but sympathy for her now.
We're speaking today with Brendan Watkins, who is the author of a new memoir called Tell No One. Brendan, we're at the stage of the program where we might take a break, and we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song. Is there a song you'd like to play for us?
Look, I do refer in the book to a Paul Kelly song called I'm On Your Side, and I've only in recent years come back to Paul Kelly and adore a lot of his recent work, and I'm On Your Side has a very special meaning that will make sense in the book, so that's the song I'd like to choose, Bill.
You've been crying a long, long spell. You've been drinking from the devil's own well. You're just hanging onto your pride. Hold on to me now, I'm on your side. I'm on your side when you think there's no one. I'm on your side when darkness falls. I'm on your side. All you gotta do is call. The trees on the shoreline are all fresh from the rain. The ship on the water is heading for the main. Open your window, let that good air inside. You don't always know when there's a change in the tide. I'm on your side when others turn on you. I'm on your side when your back's to the wall. I'm on your side. All you gotta do is call.
And that was Paul Kelly singing I'm On Your Side, as specially chosen for us today by our guest Brendan Watkins, who is the author of a new book called Tell No One, a memoir of an extraordinary story. Brendan, there are some parts of your story, I mean, where I think you do need a sense of humour, and I particularly like the story when you approach birth, deaths and marriages for your father's death certificate.
I get, long story short, there was really no denying who my father was. You know, I provided a gaggle of information to birth, death and marriage. And as an adopted person, you have very, very limited rights around access to your birth parents' data. after providing oodles of information proving who my father was, I had this bureaucrat ring after I sort of protested them not allowing me any information like birth documentation or death certificates of my father. And this bureaucrat rang back and said, oh, we recognise your father as your father, but we can't give you any information because we don't recognise your father as your father. And and I had so many similar conversations with people, both in the church and Department of Justice along those lines, that people recognised the truth, but, legislation or whatever the hell it was prevented me from finding out the information I was after.
Extraordinary. And I think, as you point out, at one stage, with the doctrine of the church where nuns are the brides of Christ, that would make Jesus your stepfather, so it gives you a special relationship when you go to church, I guess. But
which is pretty bizarre. Yeah. And given that the church doesn't really recognise the children of priests, that even makes it even more hypocritical, doesn't it?
Well, look, you mentioned briefly a few minutes ago how your mother, sometime after you were born, or shortly after you were born, she went into the nunnery for 25 years as, I guess, some sort of atonement. But it's also extraordinary that after 25 years, she just took up the relationship again with your father, it appears. Is that your understanding of their relationship?
Yes. Look, it's very complicated, and I don't pretend to be the expert at it because she's very closed about it, and my father has been dead since 1990, or 92, I think it was. They were living together, for several years before he died. But look, it probably underscores the fact that my mother is the ultimate pragmatist and a person who had very few opportunities. And so my father had retired from being a priest. Most priests retire at 75 or a bit after that. And he had money. He financially had been very successful before he became a priest. And so he bought a house and later bought an apartment and asked her to be the housekeeper. So she'd resigned as a nun. It certainly wasn't any grand love story. It wasn't the Thornbirds. She'd resigned as a nun. She had $2,000, which the convent had given her for 25 years service. And she had limited skills, limited opportunity to earn money, so she became a house cleaner. And my father, who had money, said, how about you move in? And so he was nearly 80, or a little bit older than 80. And she, she said, look, I didn't think he was going to last that long, but she would have presumably had free board and upkeep, and she moved in and became the housekeeper, as many, many women who have had children to priests are known as, the housekeeper or the cleaner or the woman that runs the presbytery or whatever it might be. It was a convenience thing for him, and it was certainly no great love story, although she did make the best of it because they did socialise together, they did travel everywhere together, and a lot of people that I've met on my paternal side said, that they were great mates. The point is it's not a relationship of equals. If he's got money, education, a roof over his head, he's secure, he's respected. My mother had none of those things, so she had very few choices.
How would you describe your father after all your investigation? I mean, he comes across in some ways as a bit of a Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah, well, the church was pretty big on promoting that idea, because he had a combi and he drove the combi between Broken Hill and Port Augusta for decades, in the old days when it was dirt roads, and he built a church because he used to be a house builder, and he built a church and a uranium mine, and he'd been a Bondi lifesaver and a ballroom dancer, and he lived this unbelievable life travelling the world, met Mother Teresa and Fulton Sheen. But everyone that knew him, and I've met a lot of people now that knew him, he wasn't a terribly settled person. He was restless. He didn't enjoy his time doing what he was doing. He was a bit of a grumpy bastard. Mm. And clearly he wasn't observing all of the rules of being a Catholic priest, as many of them don't, or half of them don't. Mm. Half of them aren't celibate. In the very least, he was a hypocrite. He was far from perfect. He had feet of clay. But like all people, we're all complicated, and you have good days and bad days, and he did live a lie. He did have a son, and he did abandon his son. He did make my mother put put me up for adoption and tell no one. I don't see him as any great guy.
You just mentioned then the celibacy, which is something you point out only came in the 12th century, but there also seems to be a different meaning of celibacy in the Catholic Church than perhaps in the community.
Yeah, there's a lot of foggy grey around that, yeah. Depending on who you read, there's 1,000 different versions of the definition of celibacy in the church. But certainly if it comes to having sexual relations, priests aren't doing it. So there's multiple surveys that have been conducted. Sipe is probably the most commonly cited. An American that used to be a priest that became an academic, and, you know, he found that half of them aren't observing celibacy. And given, you know, there's 400,000 priests in the world, and, you know, the extension of that is when you think about what the church rules are or doctrine is about with regard to abortion and contraception. And if half of them aren't celibate, there are tens of thousands, if not more, children of priests that have been hidden around the world. And it's really only now that DNA becomes or has become, you know, commonly available and affordable, and people can do it from home. It's only now that people are finding these things out. And what's, you know, what staggered me is there's so few people talking about it. There's really only a handful of people in the world that have said, my father's a priest. I think it's got a lot to do with the fact that, as the United Nations 2014 report attests, the church has been issuing confidentiality agreements, silencing people. And that's why people haven't been speaking up. But I do know there's a lot of pain out there and a lot of shame, because there has been a survey done of the children of priests. 100 were surveyed, and 56% had attempted suicide or had suicidal ideation. It's a very traumatized subgroup that the church is overlooking. And you know, the tragedy is there's really nowhere to go. There's really no organization that's secular that provides for the children of priests.
I mean, there doesn't seem to be any weakening of this doctrine of celibacy in the short term. Why does the Catholic Church insist on celibacy so strictly?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I'm not the church expert, but, you know, it's an extremely misogynistic doctrine. It's an extremely misogynistic, paternalistic organisation. Women really aren't recognised in any way within the church. I think that has something to do with it, but certainly in, you know, in the Western world, it's dying, the Catholic Church. It does in the Third World, or in some parts of the Third World, demonstrate some growth, but it's going backwards, and it will have to change. Eventually it will change. I suspect it'll change when it's too late, though.
Well, your mother has certainly been a victim of that, and how would you say your contact with your mother has over the years? Would you say it's improved, or has she become more protective?
Look, I think over 30 years, I don't think it's changed at all. When I first made contact through the Catholic Family Welfare Bureau in the late 1980s, they spoke to her on my behalf, and they came back and said, there'll never be contact, you'll never speak to your mother, you'll never talk to your mother, you need to go home and forget about Maggie forever. You know, because I had her name and her address and her age, eventually after I recovered from the shock of that rebuff, I wrote a letter and wrote another letter, and eventually she replied. It was always begrudging. And I did get to talk to her, and I did get to meet her 20 years ago. But the contact is always extremely reluctant. She just wants to push it away. And I could never understand that shame. And I feel as though I can now. Yeah, look, she's never wanted to engage. And I feel sorry for it, because I'm a good person, and she has two grandchildren who are fantastic people that they're her only grandchildren, and she'll never get to know them. She's missing out on that unnecessarily, because I don't judge her for what she's done.
Yes, she may have lost the most. And you talk in your book about a group set up by Vincent Doyle, but he sees the problem, but he sees the solution as getting the church to allow priests to enter these sexual relationships. What do you see as the solution? Do you have a solution? I mean, it seems a very difficult problem.
Well, it is, yeah. Vincent Doyle and Coping International, their ethos is to work with the church. He's an extremely devout man, a man who studied to become a priest. My view is the sorts of guidelines the church or the Vatican is preparing for the children of priests just had this very general, bland motherhood statements about, you know, everyone will be kind to everybody and the church will look after the mother, the church will look after the children, and everyone will get on perfectly and we'll pray together and kumbaya. That doesn't address the immediate problems. You know, the immediate problems I see is most children of priests I know, the church still won't recognise them, regardless of what sort of evidence they've got that the father is the priest. More than half of the children of priests I know are still undergoing psychological counselling. Virtually all of them are paying for that out of their own pocket. You know, if 56% of them have attempted suicide or tried to or thought about it, it's telling you there's a huge amount of trauma and the church needs to put its hand in its pocket and address these issues. But, you know, the church should be looking at the fact that when you find out your father's a priest, you've got a whole other side of your family that you don't know anything about, and the church has got all the records of the priest. You know, I was really fortunate that a diocese in South Australia, the most progressive in the country, gave me access to my father's material. But nowhere else in the world do I know of another child of a priest that's got that information, and it's been a fantastic gift to get that. Legally, no one knows where they stand if they're the child of a priest. You know, there's all of these sort of material steps, psychological counselling, genealogical support, legal support, and at the end of the day, well, probably the first thing the church should be compelled to do is cancel the confidentiality agreements. The confidentiality agreements, that's what Harvey Weinstein uses to silence victims, to buy silence. They should be compelled to cancel them. And they need to support in a really practical way the children of priests, the people that have been harmed, and of course the mothers.
Yes, look, it is an incredible story. I agree with Wendy McCarthy when she reviewed Tell No One, and she said, I could not put this down. It's one of those. It's a page turner, perhaps surprisingly, but it's, and you know it, and you know it's all true. So it's an extraordinary story. So look, I'd just like to thank Brendan for being so open in talking to us today. You know, about all these personal matters. Brendan, thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Really, really enjoyed it, Bill. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email. We'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to any of our shows, go to your favourite podcast app or our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or follow us on Facebook or X, formerly Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.